are listening to The Partially Examined Life. Welcome to part two of episode 120, our interview with Ava Brann on her book, Unwilling. As we wrapped up part one, Ava had just given really the practical upshot of her whole work. We're going to start off part two here, repeating a couple sentences of that, and get into our evaluation of the whole thing.
The clenched fist or willing to will resolution to willfulness is just another way of getting entangled. Some way has to be found out which is more a relaxation than a further ratcheting up of willfulness. And that's what I try to delineate in the conclusion, that reflection, thinking.
Well, what's the problem with the clenched fist? I mean, just to be the devil's advocate a little bit.
Yeah. Are you being willful now, Dylan?
I'm being willful, yes.
I can't wait till Dylan turns three.
Three score.
Yeah, okay. You know, devil's advocate is very precise here because the devil is the incarnation of willfulness and pride.
Yes. Yeah. So when we say clenched fist, I think that the image of the will, it does sound like something turned inward on itself and maybe harmful to itself. And so as an image that gets across your distaste for it and your point about it.
If I could go on with exactly that. It's harmful to yourself both because it's a kind of self, you're eating at yourself, and because it's going to be harmful in what you actually do. Now, but go on.
That the clenching, the notion of a will that is fully activated and a grip doesn't necessarily have the same negative notion. It's less receptive. It's less a notion of will as kind of relaxed, active receptivity.
Yes.
It is more of a proactive, energized, grabbing the bull by the horns kind of will.
That's different
than the clenched fist upon itself.
Absolutely.
But it's not the open hand.
No. It's not the relaxation either. It's what I call the mainline argument, namely the rational desire.
Mm-hmm. So now we're into Aquinas. Okay.
It starts with Aristotle.
Right? Okay.
It's his term, actually, rational design. But it's developed by Thomas. That's the other tradition.
Are you saying that these figures appropriate the, I think what Dylan was getting toward arguing for was, I was talking to him beforehand about social justice, that if you think that there are serious problems in the world, and a relaxed receptivity is not going to solve those problems.
Exactly.
So I need to get a hold of myself and grab the bull by the horn, whatever analogy you want to use. But certainly it's not going to be just paying attention to my body and when I get tired. You know, I need to get the job done, which is much greater than any person can actually accomplish. I need to be tireless, and that's what gives my life meaning. So are you arguing against that form of existentialism?
Yeah, certainly against tirelessness. I don't want people making decisions when they haven't had enough sleep. But I mean, that's partly funny, but it's also serious. It seems to me that the kind of relaxation that Heidegger speaks about in his late writings, letting go, letting be, which he describes as a kind of waiting for the epiphany of a new coming, that doesn't do us any good. I absolutely agree. You have to do things. But the question is, in what frame of mind and with what temperamental background you do them, whether you do them in a commanding mode, in a hasty way, in a we've got to be acting right now way, or whether you think it out, you know what you're doing, you use your judgment. And above all, you're in a mode, what I think of as the best mode to be in is of interest. Interest not in the sense of having an interest in something, which has to do with acquisition, but being interested in the world around you, being, you know, the interest literally means to be among, being among other human beings, reflecting, thinking it out, going slow, saying no to a lot of things that seem unnecessary, participating in what you want to participate in, forgetting about endless options, making a few choices, you know, with slowing down, making good judgments. And that seems to me to be a way of being in the world that has set the will aside in favor of thoughtfulness. And that's really the principal argument.
What you just described seems quite different from the Heraclitean view that you seem to be very much at home with, of fundamentally there being conflict in the world and we're part of that conflict, and that's sort of part what holds the world together and is not so bad.
Yeah, you know, that might be true, that my newfound hero Heraclitus is a little bit at odds with my newfound conviction that the will ought to be undone.
Well, it seems to me a perfectly natural question to ask, especially since the last time you were on, we were talking about Heraclitus, is what Mark just said, the notion of an active world in tension with itself and one's own activity in it. Speaking about will and willfulness would seem to be very at home in that, and where exactly it falls.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought about it before, but it now occurs to me that if the world itself is fundamentally a world of mutual contradictions, of things being held together by their tension, so to speak, mm-hmm. then maybe it makes sense that one shouldn't add to that tension mm-hmm. by being oneself intense in a crab...
A crab claw.
A crab claw, yeah.
Yeah.
In other words, there's a whole slew of human ambition, drivenness, mm-hmm. hurry. If the world really is fundamentally in tension with itself, maybe we should be counterweights in some way. I mean, that, I've never thought of bringing the two together. It's true that somehow they ought to be brought together.
Okay. Well, maybe we should go back to the mainliners who you say essentially yes. get discarded. You link them up with Aristotle and then sort He's of the supremely ancestor. Articulated by Thomas.
Thomas, yeah. What I find so remarkable about Thomas is that he's precise. Mm-hmm. And in being precise, instead of reducing the will to the moment of decision-making, which is what happens when this tradition gets discarded, that the will is thought of as making choices, decisions in the moment. And the laboratory experiments about the will are all about small decisions of that sort. So that the neuroscience of the will is all about last-minute choices, small decisions. He thinks of the will, or of the act of willing, as extended in a sequence of phases which he names. It begins with the general disposition of the will toward the good, and it ends with the execution of the will. And in between, there are phases that have to do with thinking it out, that have to do with agreeing with yourself to act, that have to do with a final decision to make a final choice about means, and then to do it. So that the will is not a single act, but it's a way of going about living.
Well, in that way, it sounds just like Aristotle in the sense of it's a habit, a way of being.
Yeah, except
a way of being.
It's a way of being, but it's not a habit, because in a habit, you're acting without rethinking it every time, right? And this is a mode of reflecting on what you're doing in various stages.
So a mode of being as opposed to a habit.
A mode of being as
in that way, it's in that way, it's active.
Right. And one important thing about this way of looking at the will is then the question of free will, which agitates everybody. You know, everybody wants to know, is the will free or not? And those laboratory experiments that are so fascinating to me, they have to do with showing that the brain acts nanoseconds before the decision is made. There are many things to complain about in that, but the main complaint is that that's not the will. That's a tiny part of the will. Mm-hmm. The way that Thomas thinks of it The reason that the will is not free for Thomas is that overall, in the beginning and the end, it is bound to its rational desire for what is good. The very thing some people object to, but that's the claim. So that it isn't free in the sense of being able to choose whatever it wants. It's already bound to for Thomas, love of God, or for some overarching good. Then the question of free will is only a question of choice among means. And for him, that's the freedom of the will, that you can choose means. So, among other things, it solves the question of the freedom of the will. There isn't any. And that seems right to me.
There's no response to the fact that Eva just said there's no such thing as free will.
Well, yeah, right.
I'm in complete agreement.
You're in agreement?
I'm not in agreement.
But you know, that can mean two very different things.
I see Aquinas as being compatible with a certain kind of compatibilism.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so reason responsiveness, and it's not only Aquinas. I mean, I think Leibniz is on the same track, yeah. But the freedom we have is not to do with being godlike creatures ourselves who sort of can stand outside of our circumstances or even our psychological motivations or any of the other determining features in the world. It's that even the apparatus of determinism, the brain, for instance, is underwriting. So for instance, if we are engaging in real thoughtfulness and real inquiry, and if we reason something through and make a discovery, it's not the case that the legitimacy of that train of reasoning simply evaporates because we say, oh, it was really just brain operations. Well, it was both brain operations and it was those thought processes. And similarly, you could say with any choice, the decision-making process, there's a freedom to it to the extent that it's reason responsive as opposed to simply responsive to our immediate inclinations. That I see as a certain kind of compatibilism. And it's certainly not, you know, yes, there's no freedom of the will if we take free will to be sort of a naive folk version of free will in which we, you know, which, so for instance, contemporaries like Sam Harris sort of adhere to, where we must stand outside of any sort of causal chain. Rather, the freedom comes in the fact that whatever the causal chain, in the case of brain states, it underwrites a subjective decision-making process, which is legitimately responsive, not just to inclinations, but to reasons.
I would ask the question of, why does anybody even feel the need to try to come up with compatibilism? And what I mean by that is, compatibilism, if we were undertaking some kind of a historical or scientific inquiry, we would never come to this position. It's one of those weird, back me into a corner, untenable type things that somebody comes up with when they're desperately trying to protect something.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I don't agree at all. I think we're trying to reconcile a certain subjective intuition of having a certain kind of freedom with determinism, especially modern scientific.
Is that kind of freedom actually free will, though? I thought one of the points here in Ava's book was to decouple the notion of freedom from the notion of will and say there can be very concrete and important ways we can talk about freedom, and that should not be looked at as choice, as the moment of choice.
I am talking about free will right now. Yes, there are, of course, other types of freedom. And I think the idea Eva outlines, it's compatible with ideas concerning becoming freer psychologically, for instance, freer from compulsions or freer from the willfulness and the busyness with which we might lead our lives. Or the, you know. But I'm actually talking here about free will, and I don't think compatibilism is bogus. I don't think it's a way to save the appearances. It actually is trying to preserve a very, very important intuition, and not simply a delusion, but an intuition about the way the world would be much different, for instance, if we weren't actually subjectively responsive to reasons. So if there's no such thing as free will, then there's no such thing as inquiry either. Because you could simply say that's reducible to brain states. When I do a mathematical calculation, am I governed by arithmetic laws or am I governed by brain states? Well, actually, both are true. But what the freedom aspect of it is the fact that I'm also governed by the responsiveness to mathematical truth. It's that responsiveness to truth which we ultimately must preserve. We cannot do away with that, no matter how much we talk about brain states.
But this all turns on what we mean by the free part of free will, right? So, you know, you've characterized the naive folk version you attributed to Sam Harris as a free will that is utterly untied or unconstrained to anything, and dismiss that as hopelessly naive. And in fact,
it's not even coherent. It's not even consistent with itself.
Just to clarify, you're not attributing that to Sam Harris. You're saying that's Sam Harris's straw man.
Yes, exactly.
That he's arguing against, right? Okay.
Yes.
A will that is unconstrained, perfectly free, mm-hmm. absolutely contingent. In other words, it's perfectly useless.
Right.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Like when you have a headline that says, scientists show that there's no such thing as free will, it's that notion of free will that's always at issue. And it's a straw man that ends up falling because it's not really even a very coherent question.
Right. You don't need science to disprove it. That's what's so annoying about it. You don't need to do any science because it's not coherent. It's not a position you can consistently hold. If you simply analyze it conceptually, it falls apart, even as a notion of the will.
But isn't that notion have a kind of deep root in the stuff that we've been talking about already? One is in contradistinction to determinism, that if you're going to revise that naive notion of free will, you're going to have to also revise what you mean by being deterministic. And the other is the notion of willfulness as being the kind of sinfulness that we're talking about in Augustine seems to me to be directly related to this, that notion of utterly untethered willfulness.
Well, it's not utterly untethered because it's directed to rebellion.
In Augustine's case.
In Augustine. But it seems to me the place where you find compatibilism rife is the philosophers who've been captivated by the neuroscientists. Neuroscientists are determinists, one at all. I've not read any who aren't. That is, they either think that natural conditions determine everything in a deterministic way or in a probabilistic way. It doesn't matter, one way or the other. But that the determining conditions of the will are totally naturalistic.
Right.
These philosophers can't imagine a world without something like free will. So they invent the notion of a compatibility between determinism and freedom. And they mean different things by it. But in the primary way that I know about, it's really a kind of sophism. If you do something willingly, that is, you're willing to do it. It doesn't matter whether you were determined to do it by your natural or psychological natural history. It's free because you willed it. You were willing to do it. That's one kind of compatibilism. If I agree to my servitude, am I free? It doesn't make sense to me.
Well, Leibniz is onto the same sort of thing, right? We've already agreed that there's no such thing as a freedom of will that's completely unconstrained. And the freedom comes in being constrained to the truth. So that's where it's actually quite compatible with Thomas Aquinas' reason responsiveness. So for instance, when I do an arithmetic calculation and someone tells me, oh, you didn't just do math, it's just your brain states work in a certain way. You tell them, no, that's silly. Those two things are compatible. I can actually do math and be subjectively constrained by my responsiveness towards arithmetical truth. And I can also be deterministically constrained by brain states, by the way that brain states follow each other. And it's precisely the same thing with freedom of the will. The idea is that I don't escape servitude or being bound by something, but what I am bound to is much bigger than mere the contingencies of my inclination. I am bound to truth in some way. So when I'm able to reason about something and make a decision about that thing, yes, there are brain states that deterministically underwrite the activity of reasoning. But that doesn't mean that the subjective truth of my reason responsiveness, of my saying, okay, yeah, I'm not going to go out today because, you know, as simple as, you know, because it's raining or something like that, that that's simply wiped away. I do have that reason responsiveness, and that is actually not something trivial. And I don't think it's right that compatibilists, again, are just unwilling to give up freedom. I think it's a widely held philosophical position. In fact, it's by far the most popular position among philosophers, not because they're simply stubbornly attached to the idea of freedom, but because they can't get around. I think they're trying to acknowledge this fact that subjectivity and reason responsiveness is something quite different than mere determinism. And because I think, again, the ultimate implication of this, if there is no such thing as a certain kind of freedom, compatibilistic freedom in decision making, then there is also no such thing as inquiry. There is also no such thing as thoughtfulness. That's the argument.
But that's the argument for why there has to be compatibilism. But is that an explanation of how there can be? See, I agree that it's got to be compatible. That doesn't.
You'd have to solve the mind-body problem to give the explanation of.
Yeah, exactly. That's in the end what it comes to. One would have to show that, in fact, thought can emerge from matter or from force and matter. But in the meantime, compatibilism is more a statement of what has to be rather than an explanation of how it can come about. Would you agree to that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So it's a problem rather than an answer.
So this book is supposed to give us a way to not be forced into that, but to have a different conceptual view of the will, which somehow lets us off the hook from being forced into this position. So tell us more about how that, because I really do want to hook up your thesis here to the debates that we had in our separate episode on free will, for instance. And I didn't, your chapter on compatibilism, which I was able to scan a little bit.
They're different compatibilism.
It still was a little unclear to me. I felt like it would be very unsatisfying to folks that are deeply into that debate, as Wes has exemplified here.
So what are you asking me to do?
Sum up a little bit more of why you think compatibilism has conceptual problems at its root, that we are not forced to a compatibilist position because we are not forced to this do or die question of there must be free will, because if there wasn't, then there would be no moral responsibility, yet there is determinism. What in those steps, where has something gone wrong?
Nothing's gone wrong in those steps, but I regard those as statements of problems, not as answers. And compatibilism is presented as an answer. To me, it seems the way to put it is the two must be compatible or else all sorts of undesirable consequences would follow. But that doesn't seem to me to be a theory.
Yeah, I absolutely agree that, yeah, to the extent that it's presented as a solution and then we wash our hands of the problem, yeah.
That's what I mean, yeah.
So there is nothing in this book that will let us dissolve the problem before it arises in the first place. That is how I was reading it.
Well, yes, if one can decouple the question of freedom from willing to begin with.
There you go.
But no, the ultimate question is absolutely nowhere have I found the slightest approach to an answer to the question how nature and thought are related.
Well,
that just seems to me the ultimate mystery. Mm-hmm. Nature and thought, nature and spirit. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, before we go any further, let's just stop for a minute. Seth, tell us about the sponsor.
Like so many of you, we are lifelong learners here at PEL, interested in finding out more for our own personal enrichment. And that's why we're big fans of the great courses. You've heard us talking for quite some time about them. We really enjoyed watching the Great Courses lecture series, No Excuses, Existentialism and the Meaning of Life, taught by award-winning professor Robert Solomon. He provides interesting perspectives to the existentialism movement, the visionary thinkers behind it, and the prominent role it still plays today, and presents it all in an engaging way. Now, having recently finished our series on Nietzsche's Birth of Tragedy, I went back and reviewed Solomon's lectures on Kierkegaard, paying particular attention to his discussion of the difference between the aesthetic and the ethical. And it was very interesting to try to contrast Kierkegaard's notion of the striving for happiness versus commitment or obligation, and trying to recast that in Nietzsche's framework around ancient Greek tragedy, which is really an attempt to reconcile our fate and our obligation and duty versus our desire to be happy. So the Great Courses are celebrating their 25th anniversary, and they have over 500 courses in many subjects, including philosophy, history, religion, and more, which are taught by top professors and experts in their field. And this content is available in DVDs, CDs, streaming, digital downloads, or with the Great Courses apps. For a limited time, the Great Courses has a special offer for PEL listeners. Order from 8 of their best-selling courses, including No Excuses, Existentialism and the Meaning of Life, at up to 80% off the original price. But this offer is only available for a limited time, so order today. Go to thegreatcourses.com/PEL. That's thegreatcourses.com/PEL. We've partnered with Paul Dry Books, publisher of Eva's book, Unwilling, that we are covering in this episode, as well as The Logos of Heraclitus from episode 79 and 10 other of her titles, to offer you 30% off and free shipping in the U.S. and only $25 flat rate shipping internationally. Go to pauldrybooks.com and enter PEL in the comments at checkout. Take a look at our blog for more details on this great offer.
Okay, thanks, Seth. So one of the figures that you bring up in here is Sartre, and I was, yes. since we've had a couple episodes on here, I was able to look at that chapter that gives you an example. Like when we brought Sartre up, we saw him, oh, he's a compatibilist, just like all these other views. He says at the phenomenal level, of course, we perceive ourselves as free or something, but then that's completely compatible with a scientific determinism, even materialism. And what always seems implausible about Sartre, the way we've considered him, is that he says, everything we are ultimately responsible for. And that sounds to us like, I must have made a choice at some point. So I made a choice to become this kind of person. And you can sort of see an Aristotelian familial resemblance in that, that, well, it might not be my choice right now whether I resist the donut or not, but I made a choice somewhere back in time to become the kind of slob that can no longer resist a donut right now. So Sartre, you know, you could read a similar thing into that, that I've, from my very conception, I've made these choices and I've built myself up over time. And so now as a result of my freedom of choice, now I, you know, and I can stop on a dime, that none of my choices in my facticity and none of these habits that I've set up in the past really prevent me from just turning around and making a completely contrary decision and moving my life in a different direction. And that seems always implausible to me because it seems like, come on, I didn't choose the difficult circumstances I'm in now. I chose some things about myself, but most of these things sort of came upon me before I was even, they snuck up on me. They came at me when I was young. They can't, you know, so I wouldn't call that a choice. However, your analysis of Sartre is that, right, the moment of choice is not where freedom comes in. That freedom is in our overall life orientation, and it is something that evolves over time. So you could say people are free, but that's decoupled from saying we always have choices. The choice becomes, in fact, for Sartre, on your analysis, an illusion. It becomes, you know, because when I bring up rational reasons, you know, so in this particular circumstances, should I do this or that? Should I join the army or should I stay home and take care of my mother? That the things that I bring up as rational reasons are themselves chosen, are themselves the product of my previous disposition. What I would consider to be a legitimate reason always comes from some deeper part of myself. So if there is a freedom in this free choice, it's because I already made these choices or had this freedom long ago in building myself. That moment of deliberation is not the characteristic moment of freedom for Sartre.
Yeah, that seems to be exactly right. Here's a way I put it to myself. It's the same thing, really. Insofar as we are determined, it's because psychology is natural science. That is to say, we are psychologically natural, and therefore it's a deterministic. The world of the spirit and of thought is naturalistic. I think that Sartre is saying we don't have a psychology. We don't have, as he would put it, an essence. We exist, we are, and we are undetermined because we haven't got a nature. And our freedom consists of making the choices which build up, exactly as you described it, into further choices. But the aboriginal choice was already made, and he says that the notion that we have rational wills is an illusion. That's just a latter-day appearance, which is essentially what you were saying.
We should all use the word aboriginal more often in the way that you are just using it there. I love that. Do we want to take this back to Thomas Aquinas, or did we already say enough about how his picture, the Sartre is really a variation off of the Thomas Aquinas version, where Thomas Aquinas likewise does not say the moment of freedom is this one last part where we choose this over this. That for him, it's that he gives a very rich phenomenology of decision-making.
And that the will is not essentially choice, but is a much more extended psychological event than choice alone, which makes it possible to say that we have choice, but not free will. And the choice really only has to do with means. He's very clear about it. He called it electio, election, and it has to do with choosing between various equally good means and occasionally between more or less indifferent ends. So he solves the free will question in that way. The most dramatically abrogated one, I call it, will to be found is in Hobbes, who simply says that will is the last impulse, the final impulse before I do or don't do something. That's what's called the will. It has nothing to do with choice. It's totally driven from behind. And that really is the version of will that is accepted in most contemporary treatments of the will.
It seems that the arbitrariness with which one could assign the word will to just this last stage or to the whole thing or to something completely or to what Sartre assigns it to seems to point for you to something that's wrong with the concept. Like a concept that's that fungible is not a real concept in the first place.
Yeah, not so much wrong, but it makes it an invented rather than, I want to say, a natural notion. If you look, for instance, I was at one point very interested in the imagination. Well, there are many, many different theories about how the imagination comes about and what it does, but there's general agreement about what it is, what it means to have an imagination. Chiefly, it means having mental images and knowing how to speak about them. That's so different about the will. There's nothing about it which anybody agrees about. Except, I mean, there's schools, but there are so many schools, and even they differ within themselves. Even compatibilism has a number of versions to it. So, yes, the fact that it's so unsettled tells me that there is something about it which is an artifact.
Yeah. Can you think of anything else in human inquiry that is as much about an artifact than about something that's like a natural phenomenon?
There are many concepts which seem to me artificial, mm-hmm. but none of them have to do with such fundamental phenomena. So no, I can't. And that's partly what drove this book. Mm-hmm.
So if the concept of will is so changeable over time, I guess I'm a little confused why the biggest objection that we've had so far to why it's bad for will to be such a prominent concept in our culture is the notion of sin that went with it at its inception, at its birth from Augustine. But clearly a lot of these, since the term will has then been so stretched to denominate so many different things. So for instance, with Nietzsche, it is explicitly has nothing to do with sin. It is antithetical to the notion of sin. It's a way of overcoming the notion of sin. So why be so down on will on the grounds of its association with sin when I'm not even totally clear that that's still its dominant?
But isn't there still a broader association between the will and what it means to live a good life? And I thought Eva was trying to decouple that at the end.
Yeah, the association of a will with sin has lost some of its force in recent times. So that was not the chief objection. Mm-hmm. It seems to me the two notions of the will that are really not good to live with is, first of all, that of a suprahuman or subhuman will that drives things and we have to give in to it. For instance, the notion that there is a future which we have to recognize and then accommodate ourselves to it. This is what's going to happen. You'd better give in to it. That's a notion of a will that is of a coming being that is going to impose itself on us. It seems to me to be simply bad. There isn't any future.
Is that a live view that you've seen in more recent philosophers? It seems like kind of a relic of the 19th century of Manifest Destiny and Nietzsche and Schopenhauer.
Everywhere. When we make decisions at the college here, we're often told, well, this is what's coming. You better be proactive. In other words, we're told that there is an inevitable future and then it needs our help. I've never understood that. If it's so inevitable, why do I have to help it? That's a universal mode of speaking. Such and such is going to happen. There's no resisting it. So go with it. Well, doesn't make sense to me. If it's so irresistible, why do I have to go with it? So that dehumanized willing, that willing of a kind of ghost or spirit that wills a future or wills a condition, that seems to me very dangerous. The other kind of willing is the one that has to do with being continually in a...
the executor of one's future.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Thank you. Good.
Just do it. Of being driven, it sounds like you mean,
Yeah, being driven and not having time, mm-hmm. not having the sense that one can be, that one can act in the world. That seems to me a very common notion nowadays. And that's part of what I mean by unwilling.
So I've been trying to accommodate this ideal that you set out, which again, sounds very much like the advocacy of the philosophical life and slow down and be curious and think about things and don't let anybody push you around, but don't feel like you have to use your will to remake yourself either. So that's one of the ideals that I have for myself. But then another one that is a nagging thing.
What if we're too busy for that? Sorry.
Yes. Is it, well, it's feeling like you should be a social activist, that there are clear problems with the world. Now, of course, if you just say, I know what I need to do to fix the world and just I will exert my will, and then you're blind to contingencies and how you should change your strategy and you're not even listening to the people that you're trying to help. Of course, there are so many problems that being too willful would then bring about. But is it at all incompatible with a steady and really, for the most part, not all that overly reflective, certainly not scholarly approach to doing good in the world, that I'm going to listen to people, I'm going to be open, you know, I'm going to be intelligent, I'm going to pursue the best strategies that actually seem to fit with the ongoing picture of the world that I can, you know, the best that I can come up with, but I'm going to fundamentally be oriented toward the future and toward fixing the obvious things that are wrong. No more thought is needed to determine that there's suffering in the world that needs addressing.
Isn't Martin Luther King really willful?
And also, yeah, and this is a larger question of, you know, are you advocating a life of the mind? And is that really for everyone, this contemplative life, as opposed to the life of action or the political life?
Let me put it cautiously. A little less activity would probably do us a lot of good. A little less growth would do us, just in the magnitude of things, probably do us good. A little bit of slowing down would probably do us good. Look, our students, right? When asked what it is they want to do in the world, they generally want to change it. Well, it would be nice to know whether for the better or for the worse. That's the kind of thing I mean. That's the simple practical application. Slow down, do a little less, think a little more, choose your causes.
Let's say you do that. Let's say you, on reflection, you decide that something needs to be changed for the better.
Yes.
And I think that part of the question that we're wandering around right now is not the notion of willfulness that is for the sake of itself, of just change for the sake of change. But once you have, on reflection, decided that some great change ought to be made, we could come up with a long list.
I'm not for great changes.
Ah.
But that has something to do, of course, as always, with my personal background of life. Uh-huh. But I am for doing little things right here now.
Mm-hmm.
Things that I think I can retract if it's not the right thing, that will do add a little bit. I mean, we're now in the political realm. And
so there's something about that makes sense. And on the one hand, you have, in the political realm, advocates of great change that, as a result of that, it leads to a kind of disaster. And then you have advocates of great change that, on reflection, seems to have been the least you could have done, and it comes too late. So, like, you think of something like ending slavery or changes in the social status of blacks in America or the caste system in India. I mean, there's all kinds of social changes that were monumental, after which there's, in some respects, no going back from, and that advocacy didn't come from incremental notions necessarily. Now, maybe there would be an argument that there were people saying, well, we should do this slowly and walk our way slowly over the cliff.
The broader question here is the tension between what it means to get an education and whether that's simply a preparation for the life of politics, the life of action. I wish students would be more egotistical at that point in their lives. It should be about expanding themselves, expanding their spirits, let's say. Maybe that sounds a little Nietzschean.
Expanding their will.
Or maybe it's just about building the kind of character that will help them lead a good life. Although I'm a little more pessimistic as I've gotten older about the role of liberal arts education in doing that. But it's, you know, that's why I'm highly sympathetic to Eva's position here. I don't know, Eva, if that actually fits with what you're saying.
That describes my position very well. There's a kind of principle of action which I find obnoxious. It's a way of saying, unless we do X, we can't do Y. Where Y is some reasonable good result, and X is the whole system. So unless we change the whole school system, we can't teach some children to read. That seems to me to be so stymieing. In other words, that largeness has to be a part of one's action, that small actions aren't what really count. And there's a lot of willfulness in such notions. Does that make sense?
It makes sense.
Yeah, no, I think that's tied to a lack of political efficacy in our culture, that we feel like there's nothing that I can do individually. In fact, there's no point in my giving to charity or any of that, because my job is just to do my damn job and pursue my own interests. And if anything's actually going to get done, it's only through my vote. And we know how little that counts. But it, you know, it's these big forces that should be at work that aren't at work. And that's what's so frustrating.
To me, the notion that in order to do the small next thing, such as teaching someone to deal with a book, for example, that in order to do that, you've got to change huge quantities of things, which is a way of not getting anything done. It is a direct consequence of what I'm trying to say, though.
I heard a dissenting grunt from Seth. Seth,
yeah,
talk.
What's that? Oh,
tell us your view.
Well,
I'm sorry.
Yeah, so much of this is overdetermined for me, because I think I might have a unique position in the sense that I have one foot in this world of the intellectual, you know, the world of the mind, and I have one foot in the world of all these motives that you describe about speed and business and entrepreneurship and change and technology and all that. And so I'm very sympathetic to Eva's argument. And I think as an explication of the history of the notion and how it's evolved, this is kind of unparalleled. I don't know of anything else where this much work has gone into the idea of the will. It's fantastic. But I still want to hold on to my criticism that will is somehow inextricably tied up with guilt and power and sin, in the sense that if you listen to the language of entrepreneurs and all these self-help organizations, right, there's always some kind of language around having to take action, to be decisive, and to do that, you have to overcome yourself, right? In order to overcome your poverty, you have to overcome yourself. And that means overcoming your fear of success or your fear of this or holding on to these emotional attachments. The narrative of the appetitive and the rational exists and is alive today in the world of people who are trying to convince you to act. Just earlier today, I heard this phrase: successful people make decisions quickly and change their minds slowly, and unsuccessful people make decisions slowly and change their mind quickly.
Yeah.
That is a diagnosis of the age if I've ever heard one. And so I have to be honest, I was not able to digest the full complexity of Eva's solution, but I think there's some kind of middle ground between saying there's a pastoral, reflective life, and there's a life of action, and these two things are somehow opposed to each other. I agree that we could use to slow down, and we could use to think about things a bit more, but I don't think we can undo the will that's out there with that as a strategy. We're not going to win by advocating that. I'm in agreement, and it's appealing to me, but I don't think we can countermand the will that exists in society by taking that action.
We have to change the whole system before we can do that.
Right.
Yes, maybe that's it.
That's a good final word.
Thank you so much for doing this, Eva. I'll admit that I got more into the book as I went on. I had a really hard time getting back to that moment of having the patience, section by section, that you do with these figures. And the position that you are arguing for, that we've been talking about, this relaxed openness, is the position to be patient enough to read the book. That's how I felt. It's a certain kind of scholarship, but I did appreciate it. And was by the end, now I'm like, oh, I wish I'd read those four other sections.
I want to say something about that. Unlike authors of great books, I'm perfectly happy for people to pick around in the book and read the things that interest them. So don't exert too much patience.
I will read all the notes in order. 100 pages of notes.
And we will certainly encourage our listeners to pick up a copy.
Yeah, I will, at the risk of sounding like I'm just trying to flatter you, Eva, it is a wonderfully written book.
Oh, and it's, don't hold it up.
It's not the kind of writing that you're going to often see in these types of books, usually.
Oh, do you mean that in a good sense?
Yes.
Yes. It's engaging.
That you hide the footnotes in the endnotes, that it's not constantly interrupting with the scholarly, even though it's a deeply scholarly work, it doesn't read in a painful way like that.
No.
I'm glowing here.
So we encourage listeners to pick this up.
I would also say that while you can definitely read it straight through, Eva's point about being able to pick through it, it also works very well that way, that you could, from the index, pick the person that you were most interested in reading about and get a deeper summary of it and pick her brown through it. It would work very well that way.
And you've also steeled me for our next episode, which we're going to be talking about Augustine's Confessions.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Is that next?
Yes.
Oh, well, you'll see exactly what I mean then.
Well, so I had already previewed it. And I, in fact, got through the whole thing as an audiobook and found it really quite painful and hard to get to the good nuggets within all this, oh, God, glorious God, glory, 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 God, 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 glory, glory. So the fact that you characterized him as, you know, if you've read his perceptive account of memory, you will know that, like anybody who has read any of him, they want to know him better. You have some kind of glowing recommendation of Augustine's style in there. So I'm going to take that as a challenge to myself to enjoy that book.
Relax your will, Mark.
Yeah, and not just try to boil it down to its chalky philosophical residuum.
I should say, you know, just to complicate, everything gets complicated. The very difficult and big book called On the Trinity, Augustine's book, has a totally different presentation of the will. So we can, you can begin at another end and you get something very different.
Yes. I was grateful in your chapter on Augustine, you know, that you were pulling from all these different sources, that I'm never going to read all those. Although it was nice to see that you, even in talking about the book, The City of God, you say, which I have not read in full. When does a scholar admit to that in the middle of a work? There might be something else in there. I don't know. And I know you didn't just search on the keyword will in the electronic copy. I know that you didn't do that.
Yes. Right. Thanks, Eva. All
thank right. you very much.
Thanks,
well,
Eva.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure being together with you all again.
Hey, folks, we're supported by your donations. Please go to partiallyexaminedlife.com to make a contribution. Big donors since last time have included John Glazer, David Vollier, Charles Wright, Paul Keogh, Jack Shepard, Ko Liang Jiao, Robert Tabb, Tracy Crook, Amog Sahu, Timothy Sullivan, Melissa Cole, Song Young Ok, Kyle Trotter, Heather Brook, Harold Johnson, Julian Taylor, Jeffrey Hrabar, Stephen Clausen, Matt Hargis, Patricia Lipscomb, Scott Khoury, Jordan Taylor, Saqib Nizami, David Kraftso, Diane Baudet, Michael Gomez, Patricia Broccolina, David Michaels, Thomas Kaiser, Frederick Kiesche, Grant Edwards, Lucinda Walker, Jacob Baird, Todd Costa, Kristen Ray Larson, Donald Parker, Gustav Toner, Cynthia Pereira Lira, Robert Mahoney, Molly Blades, William Park, Keith Schaefer, Mark Navalis, Joshua Stein, Matthew Churchill, Corey Astell, and Timothy Flavin. Thanks also to the smaller donors, including those who are newly or on a continued basis signed up for our $5 a month citizen site. If you go to partiallyexaminedlife.com, you can participate in discussions there, read supplementary material. There'll be links to our Facebook group, our Twitter account, our YouTube channel. If you use the iTunes store and you get a moment, please go there, leave us a nice review. Another way to support us is through our Amazon banner. If you click the Amazon ad on the right side of our homepage, do all your shopping as you would normally do, it'll kick a little money back to us. If you bookmark that and do that often, that's a great way to show your ongoing support. Oh, and the song you're about to hear, I Insist, a brand new recording, very spiffy. Thanks to Jeff Esty, Ken Keeley, Steve Petrinko, and Daniel Gustafson for helping me by playing on it.
Good night.
Good night, everybody.
Good night. Bye.
In place of a soul, I've got tendency. Gotta lean in. I've got energy.
Well, I push headlong into a tumbling world of my own, of my own. Oh, well, I don't know what I am driving. I am pressing the keys. I am losing what's left of my periphery. I am forward, essentially. I am motion and force and something too fast to see. My eyes focus out to a point and refract. And I will pierce every door, nothing fails to react. And I will overcome all the crap that I drag. I am not asking the world, I am not asking the world. I demand it, I insist. If I must give a reason, well consider this fist. I demand it, I require. Mistake what I make and all the love I inspire. In place of a soul, I've got irony. In the space of a conscience and rock. In this piece, my belief is a 15-ton truck. If I hold out my hand, you will shiver, will shiver. I am driving, I am pressing it down. If I fly at this speed, I will be sleeping around. I am forward, I am all the way. I'm a mistake of the future, will all be someday. And my eyes focus out to a point and refract. And I will pierce every door, nothing fails to react. And I will overcome all the crap that I drag. I am not asking the world, I am not asking the world. I demand it, I insist. If I must give a reason, well consider this fist. I demand it, I require. You mistake what I make and all the love I inspire. Don't be put out of fool to cover yourself in drool. I'm a person, and not a force of nature. Don't be one of those guys who puts feet in his mouth. I am lonely and done, I won't save you, won't save you. If I must give a reason, well consider this fist. I demand it, I require. You mistake what I make and all the love I inspire. And my eyes focus out to a point and refract and retract and turn black and go back and attack and relax and distract and react and react and react and react and react. And react and